We are going to, in our next segment, we are going to be speaking to Thabang Rapuleng. He is a director of employment practice at Clive Dekker and Hofmeyr. And we are going to be speaking with Thabang on the back of the fact that this week, or over the last week and a bit, there was an open letter that was written to the Minister of Sports and Culture, and it's essentially talking about what an actress saw as an unfair labor practices. But we're not going to speak about that particular case. We're going to speak about unfair labor, fair and unfair labor practices in a very broad sense. And Thabang, how are you? Thabang? Okay, we seem to be having trouble speaking to Thabang. But an unfair labor practice is defined in our Labor Relations Act as an unfair act or omission that arises between an employer and an employee involving the unfair conduct of the employer relating to very specific things. So it relates to your promotion, your demotion, the training of an employee, or relating to the provision of benefits. This week, the topical issue has been entertainment industry practices, but we want to have a broader discussion, and this is very important. So callers are welcome to please call us on 0861-987-000. Good evening, Thabang. How are you?
Well. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, thank you. So, if you, South Africa's business people, have said that our labor laws are too rigid, what does this mean, and would you agree with them?
Well, Lee, we've had this argument or debate about the labor laws being too rigid, coming in and out for the past, I will say, for the past 10 years, if not longer. And in most cases, when people, what people will point to will be the processes which an employer will have to undertake in order to, for example, dismiss someone or deal with misconduct in the workplace. And they feel that, you know, it's quite a lengthy, sometimes costly process. And as such, they perceive it to be too rigid. And some people are of the view that actually employees have too many rights in South Africa compared to other areas where they've got operations. But my sense on that, I don't think the laws are too rigid. I think the laws are actually quite balanced. But what frustrates employers is that even in situations where there's no adherence to the laws by the other side, in most cases being the unions, you find that they are not able to exercise their rights without incurring costly. For example, where a strike, an unlawful strike, becomes violent, you don't find law enforcement officers stepping in immediately to deal with it. The employer will have to approach the labor court, get an interdict, and then try to enforce that particular interdict. So that tends to be a costly exercise. So I think from that perspective, that's where I will say some of the processes do appear to be rigid insofar as employers are concerned. But in general, if everything was to work as it is designed to work, I will say our laws are not too rigid.
Okay. So what is an unfair labor practice? Because in our law is very specific in terms of how it delineates what fair and unfair labor practice is and what you can take to the courts or to the CCMA as an unfair labor practice.
Well, it's defined in the Labor Relations Act in Section 186 of the Labour Relations Act. And in essence, to paraphrase, is defined as any conduct or omission which happens in the employment space, meaning it must be between an employer and employee, which is deemed to be unfair, and that conduct must relate to either promotion, demotion, probation, or training, and the provision of benefits. And then it also will extend to issues such as unfair suspensions or any other disciplinary action or sanction which is short of a dismissal. For example, if someone was to get an unfair, a final written warning and they don't agree with that final written warning, they can challenge it under the ambit of the unfair labor practice, Section 186. So it's quite defined in the LRA. Mm. But in essence, with its way promotion, most of the disputes that we come across, it will be provision of benefits and issues of promotions.
Okay. So for me, one of the things that's quite interesting is that for a very long time, it was thought that only current employees or dismissed employees, as an or current employees, could actually approach the courts on unfair labor practices. So there has to be a current and ongoing relationship between the two parties. Yet there have been court cases that seem to indicate that, especially with the financial bit, with the provision of benefits, this can happen post-employment.
Yes. What matters the most is when did the cause of action giving rise to the dispute, when did it arise? If the cause of action arose whilst the person was still in the employment, then even after their termination, they can still refer an unfair labor practice dispute. But obviously, there are timelines stipulated to refer an unfair labor practice dispute to the CCMA, which is that it should be referred within 90 days, failing which one will have to apply for a condonation in order for their referral to be entertained by the CCMA or a bargaining council that is competent.
Okay. Thabang, we have Aubrey from Roodepoort on the line. Aubrey, have you got a question or comment for Thabang?
No, my comment is that I agree with the point that labor laws in South Africa are too rigid for a developing country, in my view. The country that sits with a 40% unemployment rate and does not encourage employment. Instead, you have unions actually running government. It's a problem. Because I'm not saying people must be exploited, but what I'm saying, in a country with 40% unemployment, I think it's the wrong place to be in.
So when you say you agree that the labor laws are too rigid, what about them do you think is rigid?
About the
labor laws, do you think is rigid?
It's very easy to employ someone in South Africa and extremely difficult to dismiss them, irrespective of whether they perform or not. Remember, in private business, when you run a private business, government must be encouraging. You see, governments don't create employment. Employment is created by private sector. And when private sector, remember, when you employ somebody in the private sector, you employ them to perform because you pay them to perform. And if they are unable to perform, currently there's a whole range of things that you must send them for training. It's all cost and cost and cost. No one says to you, if it's an adult, we're almost running a kindergarten. Where an adult, you're teaching an adult to arrive at work on time to do what they're supposed to do. You can't run an economy like this.
Okay,
that's my personal view.
Okay, can I ask you, in the context of us coming from colonialism and apartheid, which is colonialism of a special kind, and the fact that workers then were quite exploited and actually quite abused. Workers, employees, were quite exploited and in some instances abused. don't you see value in us having stricter labor laws to protect both the employees actually and the employer from abusive labor practices?
Well, my view is that we have overcorrected things. You know, when we took everything of the past and wiped it and started some things that we don't know. We should have at least maintained the good things. We can't say today, we can't say everything was wrong in the past. No. We have to be honest and say some of the things were right. We can talk about a whole lot of things. We can say, no, here there was expectation, these things were wrong, but there were some of the things were right. I mean, we can see today our country is not growing, and we can argue to say, in terms of job creation, if you grew up in Johannesburg, there was number 10 Fox Street, if you are old enough. People used to, they never used to allow people to roam around in the township. They used to take people and make them work. You can say, no, it's forced, whatever. But people were useful. Today, people are standing everywhere in the township, and there's no problem. Government is happy. It can't work.
Okay,
we need to learn from the right things that happened in the past. We need to accept that we have never run a country. We're failing, essentially.
Okay. Thank you very much, Aubrey. Thabang, I'm not sure if you can respond to that.
Lee, I think to a certain extent, I do share Aubrey's sentiments and frustrations, but one needs to obviously draw a line between a political space and the legal space. We are talking about the laws. Most of the frustrations that he's talking about, unions running the country and so on, those are political considerations. Unions are not really running the country because the Labor Relations Act has given them that much power. No, it has not. But because there is political dynamics in our country, which are quite peculiar to our country, where you've got a union that is part of the governing party, of the ruling party, and so on. Those aspects obviously have an influence on how they are perceived and the power that they currently commanding. But if we were to strictly look at the labor laws, the only point that I could hear from Aubrey was to say, for example, it becomes difficult to dismiss people and so on. But that is informed to a great extent by our past. It's informed by our past where we did have relaxed labor laws and we saw how they were exploited, how they were used to exploit the majority of the country. So, and we also need to balance labor law, obviously, with constitutional rights, the right to dignity and so on. If you're going to dismiss someone, that person also has a right to dignity. And the law, it's not that rigid as people make it out to be. It's the processes that we adopt internally in the workplace that are quite rigid. There's no law, for example, in the disciplinary hearing. There's no law in the Labor Relations Act or any other legislation, for example, that says if you want to discipline an employee, you must have a full-blown disciplinary hearing where there's an external chairperson, where there's all sorts of things, evidence being led, and so on. The law simply says you need to put allegations to the employee. You need to afford the employee an opportunity to respond to those allegations and take into account their submissions before you make a decision. But we have adopted workplace practices which are informed by workplace policies in the main. If one looks at those practices that we have adopted, they're not codified in the Labor Relations Act, but we find them in our own internal policies. And I will say we need to start to decriminalize internal workplace policies and go back to what the law intended those processes to be. They were not intended to be mini trials within a workplace, which is what it's turning out to be.
Yeah, because sorry, Thabang, because I mean, it gets ridiculous, right? Where people have almost like a pre-trial minute, and then there's like a trial, and you know, somebody prints out all the policies and all the procedures from the company. Yet, you know, what you're dealing with is an employee that might have come to work late, you know, and the only policy that applies there is your time and attendance policy, yet you go through an entire pre-trial minute go on.
Yeah, I was saying another thing, even the style of drafting the charge sheets. You find a charge sheet drafted in such a way that you will swear this thing is going to the High Court, where there's alternative charges after alternative charges after alternative charges, and we are really addressing one misconduct by an employee. But you draft your charge sheet in such a way that it's too legalistic, and then it obviously now forces the employee to also want to source legal services or union and so on, because and those things are not from the Labor Relations Act, are not from the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Those things are from our own internal workplace policies, which we have designed as employers.
Okay. We've got Memo Rungwa on the line. Memo Rungwa? Okay, we don't have Memo Rungwa on the line. Maybe we can try Abram in Pretoria.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Hi, Abram.
Yes. So I just want to reflect on what I was actually previously, you know, talking about.
Okay.
I need to, you know, put to your guest there that, you know, the Department of Labor is absent from the field of work where, you know, the employees, you know, are being frustrated from. I'm saying that because, you know, if you can look at the CCMA processes, you will notice that over 70% of the cases that are reported to the CCMA are black employees. And most of the employees that are not black, you know, they have an opportunity to have their matters resolved at the workplace. But the black workers, you know, are being frustrated, and they have to refer the matters to the CMA, where they are even more frustrated because of the processes of the CMA. You know, I don't want to go into detail regarding my particular, you know, experience, because now I'm still on the CMA case. But in general, you would sit, you know, in the arbitration. The first sitting, the arbitration is postponed because, you know, maybe a commissioner is tired, or maybe, you know, one of the witnesses of the employer was actually crying, you know, during the hearing. So the matter is being postponed. The second sitting, there's another problem. Maybe, you know, after, you know, you've given, you know, your evidence in chief, and then the commissioner feels very tired, you know, they want to postpone the matter. I can say to you, you know, the applicants that are found to be black, you know, in CMA, you know, they have their cases prolonged up to the period of 24 months. But you'll never find, you know, a white, you know, employee whose matter was referred to the CMA, and then, you know, it's even, you know, 6 months, you know, later, where, you know, he's still running around the CMA. So I just want to get the clarity in terms of, you know, why is the, you know, law not, you know, being actually, you know, approached, you know, in a blanket manner. This is my actually, you know, submission to you now, so that, you know, you can advise me on that.
Hello. Tabang.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe on to address the first point. I do believe that the Department of Labor needs to make it clear to the workforce as to what is their role, what is their mandate within the workplace. I believe that there is a lot of confusion and misinformation as to where does it come in and where does the CCMA processes take over. And I think it's something that the Department of Labor needs to look into so that people know exactly what is it that I can approach the department for and how do I approach the department without obviously going through long queues and so on. So there is definitely room for improvement in the Department of Labor. Insofar as postponements at the CCMA are concerned, well, I don't have the stats as to how many cases are referred by black people and how often those are postponed and so on. But in my experience, in most cases, you find postponements are not really occasioned by the CCMA itself or by commissioners. In most cases, it's one of the two parties. It's either it's going to be the applicant requesting a postponement for whatever reason, or the employer, in most cases, in a dismissal case, being the respondent, requesting a postponement for whatever reason. So it, in my experience and I've practiced in the CCMA for many years, I must yet to come across a situation where a commissioner says, I want to postpone because I'm tired and so on. In fact, in most cases, commissioners tend to push back when we request postponements. They tend to be quite difficult, and for a matter to actually be postponed, it needs to be signed off by the senior convening commissioner before it could be postponed. So the processes tend to discourage postponements. But there is a lot of postponements that are happening, but those are generally occasioned by the parties themselves.
Okay. We have Memo Rungwa on the line. Memo Rungwa, question or comment? Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, and good evening to your guest.
Good evening.
Yes, you know what I wanted to say is that there is nothing like an employer is unable to dismiss an unruly worker. There's nothing of that sort, where people always want to create the labor laws are unfair. For instance, you'll find that the employer is busy saying the workers are not productive. If the workers are not productive, the employer is also responsible for that, because what is it that is doing in order to make the workers productive? And in many cases where you find that people goes to the labor court and all that, it comes from the employer is more of a problem than an employee. It's simple. If I don't report on duty on time, I've been taken for DC, I've been warned 3 times, the law is there. It says I must be dismissed, period. You know? Now, what I want to ask the key commissioner. Sorry, hello?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I was asking if the gentleman is the commissioner.
No. The gentleman is the director of employment practices at Clive Decker Hofmeyr.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So you he's a practicing lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah. What I experienced is we went for arbitration, and to my surprise, the arbitrator, is that, I don't know if that's the correct name,
yes,
was in cahoots with management, you know, was in cahoots with management to an extent that management sat in the office until late. The arbitrator used to go down. I'm going to call him. Why is he sitting so long in his office and not coming in? And you could see that at the end of the day, Casey Itoya, which side? As I'm saying now, I've got a case nearly 5 years more tuffling, you know, but I haven't taken it to an arbitrator or a labor court. Let me not talk about it. Here's one important thing. I'd like to know, when it comes to politicians, for instance, I'm pointing at this case where the Akitsuriki Babita, the prosecutors or the lawyers who were appointed by President Zuma, and now the new president want to dismiss them, you know, basing his argument on, I don't know, it's not completed or not. This is what I've experienced or realized with a new government, is that you'll find most of the time that a worker is more frustrated by politicians than an employer himself. So I want to know, how do you define a worker who's under a politician? Does the labor laws cover him, her, or not?
Okay, so Member Rungwa, just to be clear, you are asking about people that are appointed by the president, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thabang?
Yes. Maybe let's start with the last point. People appointed by the president, if these are, with the exception, obviously, of cabinet appointees and so on, people who are appointed to various roles and in the public sector are employees and do enjoy the protection of our labor laws. There are exceptions to that rule that will apply to people in the military and so on. But in general, people appointed, even in the national prosecuting arm, those become employees and they will be subject to the labor laws and will be covered by the labor laws as in any other employee. And on one of the issues which Memo Rungwa points to, that sometimes commissioners or arbitrators can be biased, it is indeed a possibility, which is why our law envisages a process where you can review a decision of a CCMA or a bargaining council. You can take it to the labor court for a review and so on. If you believe that a commissioner misconducted himself or herself in the manner in which they dealt with the matter. So it does happen, but there is those safety mechanisms which are built in where you can then review it to the labor court.
Okay, cool. Thabang, when we come back, I actually want us to speak a little bit about independent contractors. So, just before we speak to Thabang on independent labor contractors, power listener, you are more than welcome to please call us on 0861 987 000 at Power FM 987, and our show hashtag is hashtag Power Perspective. Thabang, do freelancers and independent contractors enjoy any kind of legal protection in South Africa?
Yes. Well, the independent contractors and freelancers, and I mean in the true sense, because sometimes you find normal employees being dressed as independent contractors, but independent contractors in the true sense, their rights will be derived from it becomes a commercial arrangement. So their rights will be derived from what they have contracted upon. So one, they need to understand what they've contracted upon, and they need to be able to enforce the rights which they contracted upon. They are not treated the same way as an employee, and the rights which will be afforded to an employee will not be afforded to a true independent contractor or a freelancer. So in most cases you find where there's disputes there, it will be disputes of a civil nature, a commercial law kind of disputes, which will need to be addressed using the courts, either than the labor court, because in most cases, unless one wants to argue to say, actually, notwithstanding that this is labeled an independent contractor arrangement, in the true sense, it's not an independent contract arrangement, it's actually an employment arrangement, then it can be an issue which is dealt with within the labor the labor relations framework, either through the CCMA or the labor courts. But their rights will be as stipulated in the contracts which they will have signed, but they will not extend to Labor Relations Act, the rights in the Labor Relations Act or the Basic Conditions of Employment Act.
We are speaking to Thabang Rapuleng. He's a Director of Employment Practice at Clive Dekker Hofmeyr. And Thabang, we have Mahlomula from Olivenhead Bush on the line. Mahlomula, hi.
It's Olivenhead Bush again.
Yeah, that I can never say that word. It's just one of the ones that defeat me. I've given up. You've got a question or comment for Thabang?
No, it's actually a comment. But before I do comment, except the question, I just wanted to say that instead of calling the whole name, just say all events next time.
Oh, okay. Nyabonga bab.
Yeah, well, because kuna makampani la ngaphandle la abantu bokakhona mangena esebenzini yaslok and clock for lunch and then clock when you knock off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question to Thabang there is, say for instance, I am late, and then I don't know if, and then usually what happens is the company deducts some money from your salary because of income. Now I wanted to get clarity whether is it okay for the company to still give you a warning form on top of that, because already I'm sure that you take the money from your income.
So are you asking if a warning form is double jeopardy? So you can't be punished for the same thing twice.
That's my question.
Okay. Thabang, did you get that?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, the double jeopardy envisages a situation where you are sanctioned twice for the same offense. Okay. So where you are late, or let's say you are late or you fail to come to work, and the employer says for the time that you did not work, or the day where you are not at work, I'm not going to pay you. That's not a sanction. That's simply the, keep in mind, the only reason why the employer pays the salary is because you have tendered your services.
Mm.
So that's the employer saying you have not tendered the services, you've not earned this portion of your salary. Hence, I'm not giving it to you. But the employment relationship is also now governed by policies, human capital policies or HR policies. Now, that policy will say late coming or failure to pitch for work, absenteeism, it's a misconduct. Now, that triggers another process. Now, this is now your industrial relations or employee relations process.
Mm.
And that is the process now that will sanction your conduct. But it will not be double jeopardy, because the first one was not a sanction. The first one is simply you not having not earned what you are supposed to earn. If you're supposed to work 5 hours, you only work 4 hours, the employer is entitled to say, why must I pay you 5 hours whilst you only worked 4 hours? Then that's simply them saying, you're not getting what you have not worked that hour, so you're not getting paid. So it's not a sanction.
Okay.
It becomes the sanction will become the warning that comes as a result of your late coming or your failure to come to work. So double jeopardy will not come into in that situation.
Okay. Mahlomula, so the answer is your employer is well within their rights to withhold the money and to give you a warning.
Yeah, but Lee, from where I'm sitting, I think that is an unfair labor practice. Because to think about it, I mean, you are being, well, he says it's not a sanction, but you are being sanctioned because you're not going to get paid for that. Ne? And then on top of that, they give you a warning from the same offense. I don't know, but I think it's unfair.
Unfortunately, it's one of those things.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that the courts have considered in a number of judgments, and it's settled now in our law that it's not an issue of double jeopardy. It's just a matter of you not having worked, and because you did not work, not earning a salary. And the other one is that in the process of that, you've committed a misconduct, and then they're addressing the misconduct element.
Which is different. Thabang, I actually just want to ask you, just tagging on to that point in terms of, the thought just actually escaped my mind. I think it will come back. It just absolutely ran away from me. So can we then go to Victor from Payslip Band South Africa? Victor, you've got a question or comment for Thabang?
Yes, thank you very, very much. Thabang, yes, you highlighted a very specific area in relation to the recruitment level, whereby fairness. How does one actually base fairness? How do you know how unfair it is in relation to what you're actually getting into? Is it not based on how these recruitment firms or corporate organizations ask you for your cost to company, your pay slip, in terms of what is your worth? And by so doing that, they already predetermine what your worth is in relation to the market, is you participating in terms of that area. And then thereafter, when you're inside there, you discover that, whoa, Jack or John is earning 3-4 times higher than me, while Sipo or Nozipo are earning 4-5 times lower. Is it not about determining that recruitment level in terms of how they actually do it in terms of pay slips? Is it not a case of us making sure that they shouldn't ask us what our pay slips are worth? Because already they're in that situation where they expose us. We're exposed as the labor market.
Okay. So Thabang, I think this actually touches on a different piece of legislation than the Labor Relations Act. Very little of this actually has to do with the Labor Relations Act, because he seems to be speaking about equal pay for work of equal value, which is in the Employment Equity Act, correct?
Yes. So it is definitely in the Employment Equity Act, and I think what's important to just point out is that where a Mark does the same work or the work of the same value with a CIPO, the law says then they should be paid equally, unless obviously there's justification, and justification can be, for example, the other one is more experienced, they've got more qualifications and so on. But there are justifications that are listed. But in general, they should be paid the same. At the recruitment stage, keep in mind, with employers are also running business. They run businesses for profit. And if they go to the market to tend or buy services, to buy your services as an applicant, they do so, and they want to do so at the most cost-effective way. And those are your general rules of bargaining. It's not regulated. There's no law that says you cannot ask for a payslip, but there's also no law that says you provide your payslip. So in some cases, if you are standing in a position where you can bargain and where you can say, no, I don't want to give you my payslip, I want you to make an offer. And it will depend on the skill set that you have and how bad they want that skill set. But it's one of those things that comes, the more you find the more experienced people are, the more seasoned they are, they tend to be able to bargain better, and they tend to be able to say, I don't want to tell you what I'm currently earning. I want you to make an offer first, then I'll make a counter offer. But those things are just bargaining instruments which are being used in a commercial sense, because at the end of the day, even though we are dealing with employment law, it's employment law within a company that is there to run a business with the aim of being profitable. So it needs to take into account those commercial considerations as well.
And
but that's why there's not been any law.
And cases with for equal pay for work of equal value is if you do find that you are being or you feel you're being discriminated against, if you are earning below the Basic Conditions of Employment Act threshold of 205,433 rand, then the CCMA adjudicates those cases. But if you earn above the threshold, it becomes a little bit more tricky in the sense and more expensive in the sense that it goes to the labor courts, correct?
Yes, it goes to the labor court unless the employer consent to the CCMA also adjudicating that case.
Okay. And then here... so we have Matsi from Khalabatsani.
Yeah, Khalabatsani. Yeah.
Khalabatsani.
It's Tswana, my sister.
Yes, Likai Matsi.
Hi, Rutei, my sister. Likai, and your best. Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, you can also tell Mr. Tarande because of him. You know, hey, it's a worrisome phenomenon, you know, to me, you know, because of. Illegal strike, you know, and the responsibility of the human resource manager within the company because of, you know, sometimes, according to me, there is a javelin throw in there because of, you find workers been dismissed from work because of they go to illegal strike, you know, without applying a certificate from arbitration, you know. So, and what is the responsibility of human resources there? Because it's a gift plan. You have to balance the equation between the two. So, I know Ugari Bona, Barakisha Baberik, they don't know their job very well, you know, especially in private sector like that, you know. So, Ugaribo.
So, Matsi, am I understanding you correctly to say, in a strike situation,
yeah.
Where there's going to be a strike,
yeah.
And at this point we don't know if the strike is going to be legal or illegal, what is the role of the Human Resources Department?
What is the role? Because you have to advise workers as well, you know?
Okay, cool.
There is responsibility of the Human Resource Manager to advise workers that you have to apply... Before you go to strike, you have to apply for certificate to strike from CCMA, you know?
I hear you. Shabang?
Sure. Yes. Well, HR in general, they are the custodian of processes and policies. So insofar as employees want to engage in a process, let's say in this case, the example being used is that of a strike, yes, the role of HR will be to say, you cannot go on a strike unless you have complied with A, B, and C. Meaning, all they are doing, they are advising on a process as stipulated either in policy or in the legislation. But in most cases, you'll find that HR practitioners, they find themselves in quite a difficult place because their role is not solely to advise employees only, but it's to advise the entire organization. So they've got a responsibility towards employees and management. And there's a balancing exercise that needs to be done there. And depending on which side you are standing, they will always be easy to be faulted in that if I'm an employee and I see HR now advising management on what is expected and what they can do in response to the process, I will obviously get a sense that HR has been biased and it favors management. But at the same time, management, when HR sits with employees and say, employees, in order for you to go on a strike, you need to do A, B, and C, some of the managers will look at that conduct and think it's improper of HR to have behaved in that way, to have given that kind of an advice. So it is quite a delicate position which needs careful balancing. But in essence, if HR practitioners simply understand that they are there to advise on their policies and on their processes. It should balance itself out.
Okay. Thabang, what would be your advice to employees who are perhaps facing a bit of a dicey situation at work, and they want to protect their rights? So especially when it relates to issues of unfair labor practice. So let's say your line manager is not approving you going on training, and you feel that this is impacting on your performance, and which might have an impact in terms of what kind of increase you get at the end of the year. What are the things that employees should do, and what are some of the things they shouldn't do?
Yeah. My sense will be, firstly, make your discomfort or your disapproval of what you perceive to be the conduct of the line manager to be known officially. Don't assume that the line manager knows that you disapprove of the manner in which they dealt with your training request, for example. Because in most cases, employees simply assume that he knows that, or she knows that I'm not happy. Make it official. Write to them. Inform them formally to say, I am not happy with the manner in which you've dealt with my issue. What is the reason? Why could I not go to training? And get that response to be in writing as well. If you are still unhappy with the response that you are getting, then I will say first exhaust your internal dispute mechanisms, such as your grievance policies and so on. If there is a grievance policy, first exhaust those internal processes, lodge a grievance, lodge a formal grievance. But also, when you lodge a grievance, what employees need to do is to try and distance emotions from it. Deal with the issues, deal with the facts. Don't allow emotions to overwhelm the facts, because in most cases you'll find that because employees tend to become emotional when they deal with these issues, even when they've got good facts, they end up not communicating or conveying those facts because of their emotions. So distance yourself, deal with the facts, ask someone else to assist you in the process, which is why HR policies will always afford employees an opportunity to be assisted by a colleague, if not a union, and so on. But ask someone else to assist you, because then you can remove emotions from your complaint.
And where you can afford to, Thabang, at a maybe more senior or where you can actually dedicate some money, some resources, speaking to a lawyer would help?
Speaking to a lawyer will help, but again, because there's cost elements to it, you need to decide at what stage to engage a lawyer. Mm. For example, now in an internal grievance, where now you are raising your unhappiness internally. You are raising your unhappiness to your manager or your manager's line. I don't think it's wise, unless you do have the money, to be incurring legal costs at that particular stage. Mm. Because if you don't get satisfied with the manner in which the manager, the line, dealt with your matter, then you will have to take it externally. And that's where you might want to make sure that you now engage the services of a lawyer and incur those legal expenses.
Because because at the CCMA your grievance would be heard, de novo, so it would be a new case. It would be heard from the start.
Yes, so the CCMA is starting afresh, but it helps, more especially when you're dealing with unfair labor practices disputes, it helps to be able to show that I did raise it internally. Mm-hmm. This is how they responded to my dispute and state why I don't agree or why I'm not happy with this response by management. And at the same time, keeping in mind that you need to be guided by some form of, if you say I'm entitled to training, you need to be familiar with your training policy. You need to be able to say, the training policy says I can go on training, or this particular contract says I can go on training, and so on. In most cases, you'll find, again, employees will say, I want to go on this training, but they have not even looked at the training policy to see under what circumstances can they apply for training, and so on. So become familiar with the relevant policies that are relevant to your particular dispute. If you don't understand them, ask someone else to look into those policies and explain them to you as well. And then before you craft your grievance. So that when you craft your grievance, and when employees craft grievances, they need to appreciate that it's not a war. It's not a fight. Because the moment you engage in it as if we are now fighting, your emotions are going to cloud your judgment, and they're going to cloud your facts, and which might be legitimate facts. Okay. So always make sure that you keep your cool head and write your grievance in a proper way and be prepared to listen to the other side. And the same goes for employers. Employers need to be prepared to listen to employees' grievances without feeling undermined, without feeling, how dare he questions me, how dare he lodges a grievance without me. It's a process provided for by your own policies. And if an employee simply exhausts a process provided for by your own policies, there should be nothing wrong with that. So the same goes to management. They need to be to keep an open mind in dealing with grievances internally.
Okay. Ronnie from Soshanguve, you've got a comment or question for Thabang?
Hi. How are you, my dear?
I'm okay.
I'm okay, yes, sir.
All right, man. Guys, listen there. The philosophy behind a law, yeah, is that it regulates a harmonious integration, yeah, of the society. Yeah? Such that us being citizens, we are legal subjects. We are bound by the law. Now, it is for the reason that, look, law, the purpose of the law, as I've explained, it is to see to the best interest of everyone. Yeah? Hence, you find in Section 23, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, that that a person has got a right to a fair labor practice. Now, the reason I'm quoting is because I'm referring to the recent decision which was passed, that before on a labor matter, before people could go to a strike, there must be a vote among workers. Now, here is now the question. Since South Africa, it is a product of three currents, meaning English law and Roman Dutch law. Now, that decision, I want to know, which decision does it court? Since South African law operates in terms of precedence.
Ronnie, we're running out of time. Can you wrap up the question, because I want to give Thabang, you the benefit of Thabang's answer.
I just asked as to which decision does this decision that when workers strike, it must be subjected to a vote.
Okay.
What court decision does that one accord?
Okay. Thank you very much, Ronnie. Thabang?
Thank you. Thanks, Ronnie. Ronnie, those are recent developments from the amendments of the legislation itself. The Labor Relations Act. So it is the legislature that have decided to go that route, and obviously there would have been discussions at NEDLAC before it even got to a stage where it becomes a bill and passed into law. But in essence, it was not case law that introduced that element. But it's an element that comes from the amendment of the Labor Relations Act.
Okay. So, Thabang, just to wrap it up. So there's been a slew of recent legislation that has been passed in terms of labor relations or amendments to the Labor Relations Act, Employment Equity Act. Yet the threshold for the Basic Conditions of Employment Act has not been reviewed for quite some time. Do we have a view of when the Minister of Labor intends to do this? Have they communicated anything?
No, a simple answer is no, we don't. And they thus far, there's not been any indication that it's actually even is about to be reviewed or is under review. It has been standing at that amount, 205.433, for many, many years now. And I might have missed it, but I've not even heard unions themselves calling for it to be reviewed. So it seems to be something that is not being addressed. But you might find that there is work being done at the Department of Labor. It's just that we are not privy to it.
Okay. Power listener, we were talking to Thabang Rapuleng, Director of Employment Practice at Clive Dekker Hofmeyr. Thabang, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
Okay. Bye.